This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, spring is maple sugaring season. We learn more from Chad Troutman at Fort Stevenson State Park. But first, spring is also a fine time to make summer plans. The International Music Camp on the border near Dunseith hosts hundreds of aspiring artists, from musicians to cartoonists, to hone their skills. Camp directors Christine and Tim Bauman were recently honored for their work, and they joined Doug Hamilton to talk about what's happening this season.
Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
And Christine, a pleasure to have you with us again as well.
Thank you so much.
I mention again, because last year we talked about the International Music Camp. It's coming up, Tim. When is it, and who should be interested?
Well, it's coming up quickly. We start in the middle of June, and our first date is June 16th, and then we run all the way through July 30th.
So these are week-long sessions?
Yes, they are.
And Christine, how many students typically, in the course of a summer, come to the International Music Camp?
Yeah, each week we have around 250 to 400 students, and overall throughout the whole summer it's about 2,000.
Wow, that's a lot of students. So you need some teachers, I take it. Tim, who's teaching these courses?
Well, we hire about 190 university professors and professional performing artists to come in and teach for one or more weeks every summer.
And these teachers, then, I've got students who range in age from what?
I think our youngest camper is 10 years old, and our oldest camper for the student-centered programs are 19. And then we do have a four-day adult camp that happens at the end, and the youngest camper for that is 21, and I think our oldest camper is 92.
All right. And this adult camp at the end of the session, how much does that cost, and how many people can you accommodate for that?
Yeah, so we can accommodate about 300 people in total for that adult camp. The price for the adult camp is $280, and that covers room and board and all of the instruction that happens over that four-day period. And there is a little bit of a discount if you register before May 1st.
Christine, describe the International Peace Garden and the camp facilities.
The Peace Garden is a beautiful location. It's literally on the border of North Dakota and Manitoba. There's an area in the formal gardens where you can stand with one foot in each country and take an awesome picture with all the beautiful flowers everywhere. There's a peace chapel. There's lots of trails and hiking, a game warden museum. There's lots of stuff to do in the Peace Gardens. For the music camp, we have about 72 buildings, and some of them are quite large, and others are quite small for private lessons or smaller sectionals and rehearsals. And the buildings that we use are a combination of ones that the music camp owns and then that we rent from the Peace Garden.
The Peace Garden had this famous iconic symbol at that, the nexus of Manitoba, North Dakota. Didn't that have to come down?
Yeah, unfortunately it did due to safety concerns, but they've done a great job continuing the tradition of celebrating peace between the U.S. and Canada in the Peace Garden since then.
Is it? Is there some sort of a symbol that took its place, or is there a plan for something? Or what's the status of that?
Nothing yet has taken its place. I know there's been a few conversations and some contests and formal idea gatherings for other iconic things to take the place of the Peace Towers. But as far as we know, nothing has been decided or moved forward yet at this point.
They've done a lot of development on the Interpretive Center, where you can visit the extensive cacti collection year-round. And they have a couple statues that are new in the last few years. So there have been some changes, some really great ones, since the towers had to come down.
As you mentioned, it's a garden, so it's got a lot of variety horticulturally as well. And people can find out information about what Tim and Christine Bauman are doing as co-directors of the International Music Camp at internationalmusiccamp.com. I went there and found out, of course, that you were both deans at the music camp in 2005. And Christine, is that how you met?
It is actually how we met. Neither one of us had been campers. We were looking for summer job opportunities as we were music education students at two different universities in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And we met over the trash can in the back of the dining hall in 2005.
All right. So is that trash can still there?
It probably is. I know we've done a couple of upgrades since then, but I'm sure that the original trash can is around somewhere.
Well, I think it needs a plaque with the Bauman name on it or something like that. Tim, you have students. This is an international peace garden, and I assume you've got some students who cross the border from Manitoba. Do they come from other countries as well?
Yeah, they do. So in addition to the United States and Canada, we usually have around 13 countries who are represented in our enrollment. So this year we've got students from Luxembourg and Norway and Sweden and students from Austria. We also have some folks coming from Honduras and the Bahamas and Dominica, from Bosnia and Herzegovina, from Macedonia. We plan to have students coming from Hong Kong, and then we also have students from Kuwait, Lebanon, and Egypt.
Now, do some of the students stay for more than 1 week session? I assume that's possible.
Yeah, a lot of the international students come for 2 weeks just because by the time you travel halfway across the world and then get your clock reset, you want to enjoy time a little bit here before you have to head home. And then we have a lot of campers. I would say a majority of them come for only 1 week from North Dakota and Manitoba, but there are several who do multiple weeks, whether it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We have one camper who has done 5 weeks for the past several summers, and he just kind of moves in and spends his summer at camp. So there's a lot of different options. Any program that's applicable, campers are welcome to attend.
Christine, I mentioned that you and Tim met each other 14 years ago at the camp. How did you get to the camp? What drew you there in the first place?
For me, in all honesty, I was doing Google searches because I just didn't want to live at my parents' house in the summer, and I wanted to have a great activity. But the fact that it was such a unique location on the international border, I was pretty excited about that and fell in love with the camp quite quickly. It's something that I just really believe in strongly. It's a place where people from all around the world can come together and work together to create some beautiful art or music or whatever else. But it's a wonderful place for worldwide friendships to happen.
Tim, it's a pretty place. It is a camp. You've got music instruction, but it is a camp. So what else happens there?
Yeah, so the campers stay in the dormitories. It's a residential camp, so parents drop them off on Sunday and then pick them up on Saturday after the concert. And in the dormitories, we do have some cleaning responsibilities. Those of our listeners who are former campers, you probably remember some of the cleanest dorm of the day competitions and everything that goes with that. There's also just a lot of free time and downtime and green space. So while we're not necessarily an athletic or recreation camp, we do have recreation equipment and space. And, again, it is gorgeous in the summer months to be up there. So it's just a great time to be outside and doing whatever.
Well, Christine, I remember when I was going to camp in the summer, occasionally there'd be this round the table you must go kind of thing at the dinner table. There was a fair amount of activity when people sat down to eat, too. Do you have these sorts of traditions that go on at the International Music Camp?
Oh, absolutely. All meals are just such a fun experience. And my favorite thing to do is actually to sneak into where all the campers eat lunch and eat among the campers. And sometimes they realize that Tim and I are sitting there and other times not. But it's so fun to hear all of the just bubbly excitement all around us, get to hear about things that are happening and parts that they really enjoyed. And then sometimes they do realize we're sitting there and they get kind of subdued, but we get to chat with the campers and find out what their favorite parts are and what they're enjoying. And I love mealtimes at camp because I love being able to be in the middle of it and all the excitement, and the food is delicious too. So I don't think anyone really goes hungry at camp.
Tim, you've got all of these, a couple of thousand of students there who are learning music, and I assume there are different levels, different kinds of instruments, that kind of stuff. Describe the variety you offer.
Yeah, so it's important to start out with the fact that in addition to the music programs like band, choir, and orchestra that we offer, we also do have several other types of programs like dance and theater and musical theater. We have a creative writing program. We have seven different visual arts programs that include digital photography, sculpture, painting, cartooning, and a couple basic arts surveys. So there really is kind of something for everyone in the fine arts. And then within each one of those programs, there's diversity of age and experience level. And we find that it's really cool to see all of those different disciplines interact with one another. And each week, because they have different combinations of programs, has a very different feel. For example, the Garage Band Week, which happens over Canada Day and the 4th of July, is like all rock band. And so that week has just a very different feel. It also has musical theater. So we have two very distinct programs that happen that week, and it's so cool to see everybody interact and go through normal camp life together, even with all these different interests. And every week is unique and different and really cool in its own way.
So are there collaborative experiences as well?
We have had some collaborative experiences in the past. Our Garage Band program, just for example, has done some partnerships with the creative writing and digital photography programs when they were offered at the same time. So the band would get a headshot and a bio and kind of do an advertising campaign around camp, working with those two other programs. And we try to find similarities and crossover when we can to have those things happen. And another example would be Fifth Session, when we have our vocal jazz program and our jazz band program. We have some faculty members from the jazz band who play with the vocal jazz to give them a true combo experience.
So, Christine, there are performances.
Yep, there are. Every week, so campers arrive on Sunday, and they work on music all week. And on Saturday, they have performances, concerts, et cetera, to kind of show off what they've done over the course of the week. So for programs like musical theater and the dance programs, they have performances. There's concerts for all the music programs, art shows and exhibitions for anything that's visual arts. Saturday is just such a fun day of celebrating everyone's success, and I love seeing all the different programs go to each other's concerts or art exhibits and really cheer each other on at the end of the week.
How about Mom and Dad getting to see everybody perform, too?
Yeah, and that's one of the best parts is families and parents and families, sometimes extremely extended families, all load up and pick up the stuff out of their camper's dorm, and they get to have lunch with them in the dining hall. It's fun to see the campers teach their families how to go through the dining hall line successfully, and then have a concert and head home.
Tim, this is the International Peace Garden, so there are people coming there for that as well. Do they take in your offerings too?
Yeah, we have a pretty awesome collaboration with the International Peace Garden to make sure that people who are coming to just the Peace Gardens know about the events that are happening at the International Music Camp. All of our concerts are free and open to the public, and so we have some folks who are just kind of passing through or might be camping and spending the weekend in the gardens who stop in for all of the multitude of concerts and performances and exhibitions that are happening on Saturdays.
Well, you and Christine have been there now for several years. You're co-directors of the camp now, so at this point you must have sort of an alumni cadre out there, people who've been to the camp and maybe still interact with you. Do you do that?
Yeah, we have a pretty awesome following. Looking back at our 64 years of operation, we've had 138,000 people attend IMC. So it's a pretty extensive reach of people, and we just love being able to interact, whether it's here in Minot, where we call home in the off-season, or up at the gardens in the summer, or traveling around as we do promotional work in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Montana, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. It seems like everywhere we go, we mention what we do, and people's lives are affected, whether they went to camp or their children went to camp or their friends or parents or people they knew went to camp. So it's really awesome to have that support, and then also to be able to continue to encourage everyone to be involved. And we really see what we do as a mission and a service to the communities in our region. We know that campers who come to camp, their lives are made better and their horizons are expanded by learning and growing as musicians, and they take that home with them. So we really love being able to travel around and meet people whose lives have been positively affected by IMC.
Well, you're mentioning about 2,000 kids, people, young adults in some cases, or adults come each summer. So a full week is in the neighborhood of $400 to $500. A half week is about something less than $300. So is that the sole source of funding for the International Music Camp, or do you have other you know, forms of revenue too.
Yeah, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and I would say tuition is probably our largest source of revenue, but that is just for our operational costs. We really try and keep all of our maintenance and upkeep and supply costs completely separate. We have amazing donors who donate to several endowments that we have, whether it's a scholarship endowment for need-based scholarships or our development fund to help us with new chairs and stands and other necessary equipment, such as kitchen trays. We also apply for as many grants as we can to help keep everything running and running smoothly. There are several different ways to contribute and help support the International Music Camp.
So of those 2,000 people who attend the International Music Camp at the International Peace Garden every summer, how many of them would be subsidized by some form of scholarship or additional support?
I would say probably 40 to 50% of the campers who come do get additional support either from their community organizations or their school or scholarships. And you know, we have definitely the smallest portion of scholarships that are given. Communities and schools are the largest supporter of campers coming to the International Music Camp. But again, kind of in that 40 to 50% of range of campers come with some form of scholarship.
And you and Christine, Tim, are in Minot when you're not at the camp. So is this International Music Camp a full-time project? I mean, is this something you have to spend the entire year on?
It is a full-time job for us, and we have a third administrative assistant who's a full-time employee. And we keep all the gears turning and things moving forward in the off-season when it's cold. And then when we get ready for the summer, we hire our 60 support staff and the 190 or so teachers.
Wow.
then we bring them in and camp happens.
Well, Christine, I do notice from your bio that's on the website, internationalmusiccamp.com, that you and Tim are both active in the Minot music scene as well.
Yep, we sure are. We both play in the Minot Symphony Orchestra. And then the two of us, we conduct and run the Minot Community Concert Band. I usually play percussion when I'm not on the podium, and Tim sometimes does percussion or any woodwind instrument that's needed in the off-season.
And Tim and Christine, you recently received the Distinguished Service Award from the North Dakota Music Educators Association. Reflect on that honor.
It was a pretty amazing honor. The award is selected by our peers, essentially, the Distinguished Service is meant to recognize people who just contribute greatly to music education and the mission of music educators in our state. So for both of us to be selected was a great honor, and I don't know what else to say. It just meant a lot to get that support and encouragement from the people that we really respect and work to serve.
Tim and Christine Bauman are co-directors of the International Music Camp. You can find out more, including registration information, at internationalmusiccamp.com. Tim and Christine, thanks for being with us on Main Street today.
And they were visiting with Main Street's Doug Hamilton. Coming up next, Harvest Public Media.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Fargo-Moorhead Opera's 50th season closes with Bizet's seductive and dramatic opera, Carmen. The naive Don Jose falls for the beautiful cigarette girl, Carmen, but this free-spirited gypsy cannot be tamed, and Carmen grows tired of Don Jose when she meets the glamorous and exciting torador, Escamillo. This messy love triangle is doomed. Performances are at 7:30, April 12th and 13th at Festival Concert Hall, NDSU. Tickets at fmopera.org or 701-239-4558.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The currently under construction National Bio and Agro-Defense Facility in Kansas will be a lab for studying some of the most contagious and deadly animal diseases in the world. In the second installment of a three-part series for Harvest Public Media, Brian Grimmett takes a look at why researchers want to study these diseases and why they say a new facility is necessary.
In 2001, an outbreak of foot-and-mouth disease rapidly spread through the United Kingdom. It's a highly infectious disease, causing high fever in cattle, pigs, goats, and sheep. It also causes painful blisters on their mouths and feet.
This year, the bucolic sights and sounds of Britain in the springtime have been punctuated by the signs of slaughter and death.
As that clip from a 2001 PBS NewsHour story says, the illness is often fatal, either naturally or because the government orders all animals near an outbreak to be killed.
They ended up slaughtering over 6 million animals and with losses of over $10 to $15 billion to their economy.
That's Luis Rodriguez. He's the director of foreign animal disease research at Plum Island Animal Disease Center off the coast of New York State. He oversees the United States research into foot and mouth disease, from how to diagnose it to finding ways to vaccinate against it.
With current trade and illegal movement of animals or even people around the world, the probabilities of foot-mouth disease entering a free country have increased and probably will continue to increase over time.
Right now, Plum Island is the only place in the United States allowed to research live foot and mouth disease in animals. But the facility is more than 50 years old and will soon be replaced by the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, or NBAF, that's being built in Manhattan, Kansas. When completed, NBAF will be home to dozens of Biosafety Level 3 research labs, or BSL-3, capable of holding large animals such as pigs, cattle, and sheep. These are some of the most secure labs that can be built and are specifically designed to contain potentially deadly diseases and viruses. Nancy Connell is a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. She thinks the money used for NBAF should have been spent on upgrading Plum Island, which is off the coast, rather than bringing foot and mouth to the mainland.
If there is a place where working with large animals with a disease that's that infectious and that easy to spread on the bottom of boots and so forth is, is possible, why not exploit that?
But there are already more than 1,000 BSL-3 labs on the mainland, including 14 at Kansas State University's Biosecurity Research Institute. The facility was completed in 2008 and is home to research on African swine fever and Rift Valley fever, two animal diseases on the list of priorities for NBAF. But Biosecurity Research Institute Director Stephen Higgs says his facility is not nearly big enough to cancel out the need for a larger facility like NBAF.
We can do a lot of the research, but not at that sort of scale, especially with foot and mouth disease, which again is very complicated. There are multiple different types, and you need that capacity.
Only a few of the Biosecurity Research Institute's high-security labs are capable of handling large animals. NBAF will have 46.
So it's adding a new capacity to the U.S. that we just don't have. We need, but we don't have.
In addition, NBAF will have even more secure labs, known as BSL-4 Large Animal, joining just three other research facilities in the entire world. That means during an outbreak, researchers won't have to beg the labs in Canada, Australia, or Germany for space. The BSL-4 labs will handle diseases that can infect humans and animals and have no known vaccination or treatment. They're killers. Luis Rodriguez with Plum Island says most newly discovered diseases fall in that area. And well,
we don't have effective tools for some of the main diseases that have emerged around the world.
If we don't develop those tools, he says, the country risks being unprepared for an outbreak that could cost the agricultural industry billions of dollars. And even more importantly, risks human lives. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Grimmett.
Harvest Public Media is a public media collaboration focusing on America's rural and ag issues. Still to come on Main Street, we learn about a maple sugaring event, and we have an essay from Mark Trahant. But now, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says it's a win for supporters of the FM diversion. A federal judge in Minneapolis has changed his injunction that stopped construction and will allow limited work.
What this does, we have a $46 million contract with the Corps on the inlet. It allows that to go ahead. It allows them to go ahead on the wild rice. But more importantly, it allows us to bid the P3. So if you're going to keep the cost from going up, we got to get going on building. The 6.5-year build, if you can get it built, you can hold your cost down. As we keep delaying, that adds cost to the project.
The P3, referred to by the mayor, is a public-private partnership that brings non-government interests into the process. Governor Burgum is also pleased with the decision, saying it will allow construction to move ahead on a critically important project. A plan to create a new state day park along the Missouri River south of Bismarck has been revived. The 2015 legislature originally passed the plan. It took 300 acres from the Department of Corrections Missouri River Correctional Center to create the park, but the State Parks and Recreation Department didn't have the money to develop the park, and the land was conveyed back to corrections. The House has now added language to the park's budget to again establish the day park, and Bismarck Republican Representative Bob Martinson authored the amendment.
There are not going to be softball diamonds there or lots of picnic tables, and it's not going to be what you would normally consider a park with swings and so forth. There would be more of a nature park, a habitat park for native plants and things like that. Just a family area where parents or teachers could take children to view nature in its natural habitat.
There's no money in the budget bill right now to establish the park. Martinson says he's hoping to add some money when the park's budget gets into a conference committee. And a Democratic lawmaker is indicating the political fight over funding for the proposed Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library may be over.
I think the governor will get his library. There's been some creative conversations over the last week. The biggest concern we all have is $50 million in one shot is a lot of money. I think there's people who are willing to pay for it over five bienniums in small amounts or whatnot. So I think there's a group that's looking at the Bank of North Dakota that could front the money, and then the legislature can pay it off over the time period.
House Minority Leader Josh Boshey of Fargo says the money would be enough to create an endowment for the estimated $150 million project. The library would be built in Medora and paid for by with a combination of public and private funding. Supporters say it could attract more than 100,000 people each year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. And in this week's Trahant Reports essay, he asks the question, what difference does it make to have Native Americans in Congress? And he says that the recent debate over the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act serves as a case study for how diversity impacts lawmaking.
I can't think of another issue where Indian Country was more front and center than the debate in the House over the Violence Against Women Act. Representative Charisse Davids, Ho-Chunk, a Democrat from Kansas, sat in the Speaker's chair and presided over the debate. Representative Deb Holland, Laguna Pueblo, a Democrat from New Mexico, introduced amendments that could make the law more effective in Indian Country. And Representative Tom Cole, Chickasaw, a Republican from Oklahoma, made the bipartisan case, telling Republicans about the big picture and the significance of the bill, while urging Democrats to find a compromise that will ensure that the bill becomes law. The fourth tribal citizen in Congress, Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, from the Cherokee Nation, also a Republican from Oklahoma, continued his long opposition to this legislation. The House passed this expanded version of the Violence Against Women Act, including a renewal of the tribal provisions, as well as new measures to improve the collection of data and provide resources to American Indians and Alaska Natives living in cities. And amendments by Representative Don Young, a Republican from Alaska, would give five Alaska Native villages new authority to prosecute sexual crimes in a pilot program. Congress voted 263 to 158 in favor of the Violence Against Women Act. 33 Republicans joined the majority Democrats in favor. But the legislative path through the Senate is complicated by sharp divisions. Holland said, "I belong to a community where women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average, and the silent crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women is linked to violence." The legislation now moves to the Senate, where many of the House priorities could come to an end. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell decides which legislation will even come up for a vote in that body. While there is bipartisan support for the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, there is also significant opposition because of the expansion of transgender rights and a provision that strips gun rights from people convicted of misdemeanor crimes for abuse or stalking. The current law only applies to felony convictions. That is one of the provisions that some Republicans in the Senate hope to remove. Leader McConnell has called for a clean extension of the act without the new provisions. And Senators Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from California, and Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, are working on another version of the law. I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark Trahant blogs at trahantreports.com. Coming up next, maple sugaring.
It's never too early to start estate planning. Join Prairie Public for a free Lunch and Learn, Financial and Estate Planning Basics, Tuesday, April 30th at 11:30 at Prairie Public's television studio in downtown Fargo. Explore important issues such as tax reform, charitable IRA giving, choosing an executor or a trustee, working with an attorney, and paying attention to who's in your will. Register online at prairiepublic.org/lunch or call me, Cassie Shipley, at 701-239-7538.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And as the snow melts, but we sometimes get those cold temperatures still at night and mild temperatures during the day, perfect weather if you are on the hunt for that wonderful sap that comes out of many trees near you. And my next guest is going to let us know about an event on maple sugaring. Chad Troutman is the park manager at Fort Stevenson State Park outside of Garrison. Chad, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So it's coming up on April 13th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. People can go out and learn about the process of maple sugaring and actually get to do it themselves. If they want to come an hour early for pancakes, that gets going at 9 a.m. You've got a couple dozen trees here that you're working with. What is the process of extraction?
Well, it's a good question. So we're waiting for that period where it's freezing at night and thawing during the day. And with that being the case, once we see that process happening, then we will go out and tap our trees by simply drilling holes into the side of the tree. We have to select a tree that's the appropriate size, and we'll drill a hole in the side of that tree and hang a bucket on it or put a hose off that and collect the sap. So.
And typically you want maybe one or two holes, and it's got to be a certain, is it 12 inches in diameter, a tree? That
you're
you...
correct, yep. Okay. They recommend between 10 and 12 inches in diameter is the size of the tree, which is generally around a 30 to 40-year-old tree.
Okay.
And so we measure that at about chest height or 4 feet off the ground. They recommend you can do up to two taps on a tree that's 20-plus inches in diameter. However, here at Fort Stevenson, a number of our trees that we're tapping are in our campground areas, so we prefer just to go with the one tap, so we're taking less sap from the trees than normal, I guess you would say.
Because it is kind of slow. I mean, it's not like hot water coming out of a tap at all.
No, absolutely. It is very slow, and that's the interesting thing about the sap is when we have people look at it, it is exactly looks just like water. It's very clear that sap is only around 2% sugar, and we need to boil that down to get to about 66% sugar to get to syrup, and that's when you can bottle it and legally label it as syrup, is 66% sugar. So there's a lot of water we have to get off that sap.
Will participants who show up April 13th, and again, the maple sugaring event gets going at 10 a.m. at Fort Stevenson State Park, will they go through the multi-stages of this? Because it's usually not all done in one day.
You're correct. Well, on the day of April 13th, we will show the participants for the event how we're tapping our trees in our park. We'll take them to, I guess we'll call it the Fort Stevenson Sugar Bush, where our planting of trees that we're using, and we'll let them see the trees that we've tapped. We'll hopefully on that day, and it looks like this weekend will be a good sap run, so it should be a great day all the way around for us, not only just to show the process taking place. If the weather holds as it's showing, we should have sap dripping out of our trees, so it'll be ideal. And we'll give them a chance to see that. We'll explain how we're doing it here at Fort Stevenson. And then we'll have our evaporator actually boiling down sap. But you're correct, it does take quite some time. We'll be boiling or trying to boil down around 60 gallons of sap. And with that being the case, our evaporator can boil between 8 and 10 gallons in 1 hour. So it'll take a good portion of the day for us even to get it boiled down to syrup. And generally, we just get it close. We might get it to around 50% sugar in our evaporator, and then we finish it off when we can control the temperatures a little bit because our evaporator is a wood-fired stove. So it's hard to regulate the heat on that. So.
Will people get a chance to take some maple syrup home?
Well, they everybody will get a chance to taste our box elder syrup, and that's what makes it kind of a unique event, is we're tapping box elder trees. And most public don't think of box elders as a maple, but they
right.
actually are a maple tree. So we will have that box elder sap or syrup, excuse me, available for everyone to taste. It's kind of most people are just very pleased and they enjoy the flavor of it. It's different than a sugar maple syrup, which is your typical table syrup you would see for pancake breakfast. So they'll all get to sample that. However, we don't produce that much syrup here at Fort Stevenson. The trees we collect, we get between, on our best year was 80 gallons of sap, and it takes 40 to 45 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. So we don't make
wow.
very much of it. No, yes. And so in recent years, we've come up with an adoption program where you can adopt a box elder tree in the state park. And with that, you'll get a small bottle of box elder syrup to take home if you wish.
Yeah, I don't think that I have ever heard box elder syrup, but I was reading about it. Yeah, box elder is a species of maple trees. Some people would be hard-pressed to tell the difference in a blind taste test anyway. Can you tell
oh,
them
yeah.
apart?
Well, I think, you know, the syrup that we produce is very light, and the appearance is like honey. It's very kind of a light caramel, light yellow appearance, and that's what you see in the very light colored grades of maple syrup, and usually the early sap that they'll collect, they'll get that light amber. And most of our syrup will be that color when we boil it down, to me, that's just kind of a traditional box elder syrup. It just doesn't take that darker color.
Can you mix, you know, sometimes with olive oil, there is also grapeseed oil that's mixed in, or just sometimes you get a combination of oils. Could you do a box elder? Because I know you're going to be tapping box elder and silver maple trees, and you mentioned sugar maples too, and there are different species of maples that get tapped. Can you mix them all and have just a blend?
Oh, absolutely. And when we started doing this tapping here at Fort Stevenson, just in Garrison, North Dakota, I started researching more out east on some trees that they have been tapping, and I've been in touch with a couple of producers that actually have box elders on their property in New York State, and they say they just mix it right in with all of the rest of the sap, so they don't separate their sap out. So it might lend itself to just a little difference in taste between sugar breakers out there. So,
okay.
Yep.
How can you tell if a tree is a good sap tree?
Oh, that's a great question. since we started doing this in 2015, we actually started recording it. In 2014 was our first year of tapping trees at Fort Stevenson, but we started recording the amount of sap we get off of a tree on a daily basis. And then, of course, the temperature. And then the last few years, we've actually been checking the sugar content at the same time. So it's very interesting how we'll have one tree that might be 100 feet apart from another tree, and that one will give us 15 gallons in a season, where the other one will only give us around 6 gallons of sap in a season. And also, the sugar content will be different between the trees. So I don't think I've mastered how to tell which one's going to be a good sap producer, but we're just pleased to have those that are good sap producers in the park to be able to boil it down. So.
What about more generally speaking, how do you know if it's going to be a good sap year?
Oh, well, and that we've seen some bad years and we've seen some good years, and 2015 is our best year so far, and hopefully 19 here will beat our record, but that's when we received around 83 gallons of sap. We had 16 good days of sap flow, and those sap flow days, of course, are when we go below freezing and then above freezing during the day. Unfortunately, last year was our worst year with around 17 gallons of total sap collected. Last year, we seemed to have our winter held on forever, and then as soon as it let up, of course, we only had a few days of spring, and it seemed like we jumped right into the summer. And the trees won't throw off sap, or sap won't come out of the tree if the temperatures stay above freezing at night. So and after a period of time, eventually the sap will get, so the sap comes out clear when it's desirable, and then it'll get cloudy, and then it'll take on a discolored appearance, and that's no longer desirable for producing maple syrup with. And we just had 6 days last year that we were actually able to capture decent sap to collect for boiling down. So yeah. That's probably one of the reasons, main reasons why North Dakota is not producing commercial maple sap or syrup. So because it's so unpredictable.
Yeah. So you're like the flood mitigation people. You want that spring to be slow and a little cold at night. And some of us are just like, nope, I want it to be 85 right now.
Yeah. And I was in the same boat before, but now I'm more of a, yes, I agree with you. I'm more slow. Yep.
Yeah. Mother Nature, when you really start to listen to her, you got to learn patience.
Yes. Yep.
What do you call people who come to an event like this? Are they sappers? Are they sugarers? You know, like foraging? I don't know what the right word is.
Well, it's interesting. It's been so much fun, and that's, I think, would say I take the out of the event. It's such a rewarding event for me. I had a passion for tapping maple trees, and even as a young kid I would watch videos and think that this is just the neatest thing, that you can tap a tree. And of course I, as a young child, thought, boy, syrup came pouring out of the tree. I probably, as some young children, have that same thought. And mm-hmm. when I learned of the possibility, I always thought, well, that's those lucky people out east that had this ability to do this. And when I learned that we could do that with box elders, I just knew, and my passion told me, we just have to do this. And so it's been a lot of fun. Once we started tapping trees here at Fort Stevenson, I will say I get people who call me and say that, no, I've got trees in my backyard. I'm going to go ahead and tap them. Can you help me with this process? And I have some people that I've been talking with now since 2015, once we went public with it, over the years, explain to me their process, how much syrup they're getting on an annual basis, what that looks like. And it's just a lot of fun. But these people that are coming out to the event, a lot of them are just really interested in something. I think in the springtime, they're just cooped up all winter long and just really looking forward to something, some kind of festival. But there are a number of them that are interested in producing their own syrup. And so it's, they call them sugar makers. And so I think there's a number of people just with that. They've got a few trees in their backyard, and by golly, can I make this work for us too? So it's a lot of fun.
Well, I would think you got to have quite a bit at home. I mean, you mentioned that you need gallons and gallons and gallons of sap just to make a little bit of syrup. Do you end up disappointing the would-be do-it-yourselfer?
Well, you know, if they have some good trees, if they have good trees, like I say with ours that produce 15 gallons, you could get to a point where you might be able to produce a half a gallon for yourself or so. But no, there is the possibility if you just have a couple of trees and they're going to produce like some of our lower producers, yes, you may not be all that happy. The one gentleman that I do visit with, he does have a number of trees on a property near a river that he's able to collect, and he's producing almost more syrup than we are here at Fort Stevenson. So,
are there rules about just going and tapping a tree? Obviously, if it's on your own property, you can do that. Somebody else's property, you got to have permission. But what if it's something like a park or a stretch of public land? Can people go and tap trees?
I would say in that case, you'd want to get permission from either the landowner, and if it's public property, you would want to find out who is managing that property to get permission. I can't imagine anybody would appreciate just sneaking out there and trying to tap. And with it being such a slow process, meaning that you're going to be collecting it on a daily basis, and it could be 16 days, it could be longer, and obviously you're not going to be able to sneak away from somebody. So the best practice would be, of course, to get permission from anybody who's managing the property. Yep.
We're visiting with Chad Troutman. He is the park manager at Fort Stevenson State Park outside of Garrison. There is a maple sugaring event coming up April 13th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the park. At 1 hour early, at 9 a.m., you can show up for a pancake feed from the local Optimist Club there. Chad, let's talk about the educational component of events at parks. Yes, of course, after the polar vortex this year, it's really nice to get outside and just do things. But also, state parks, there are learning opportunities. So what is the educational component to maple sugaring?
Oh, very good. So we actually, 2 weeks prior to the event, we encouraged school groups to come out and take a personal tour, if you will, or a private tour of the grounds and of the maple process. And we encourage those schools that they'll get a special talk. We explain to them the history of maple collection, maple sap collection. We show them the tools, just like the public gets to see on April 13th. And then we also give them the opportunity to try our box elder syrup. This year was on ice cream, so I didn't have any children complaining. But it's we do explain to them the sugar content, how we're collecting that sap, and how often it has to be collected. We teach the kids how to measure a tree, the diameter. It's fun to see some kids will think going around the outside is the diameter, and so we try to incorporate a little bit of that into the process, and then, of course, we explain how that process goes from some clear liquid that looks like water all the way down to something so sugary and sweet that you would enjoy on your pancakes. Also, we have a bluegrass band coming to play. There's all kinds of things going on with a horse-drawn wagon ride, as well as there'll be kids' hands-on activities where they'll be able to earn a patch program, such as they'll tap a tree in the park that we have. It's basically a stump that we've cut. And then they can go ahead and use a bit and brace, and then we'll give them neck yokes to carry sap around. And so just kind of some fun activities for the kids.
What other events do you have coming up this summer?
We have a number of events coming up for the season. The next big event after this one will be Memorial Day weekend with our EMS Kid Strong starts on Friday. And then on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, we have our Big Kite Festival. We have Frontier Military Days, which will be coming up in June. Event where we host reenactors. There'll be cannon firings in the park. We just have a lot of fun activities, lots of kids' hands-on stuff, and we feature some speakers at the park. And we have a number of fishing derbies, but as we get into August, we have Club Ski Nautique performing at Fort Stevenson, and they do trick skiing on Lake Sakakawea. Just been a very big crowd pleaser the last few years. We do bring in a band and have a lighted boat parade, which is a unique experience, once again, for the public, and it does seem to be very popular. We also have a sailboat race as we get into later into August, and that is August 24th, along with our beach party event in the evening. So the sailboat race will begin during the afternoon, and beach party will go into the evening. We spread a bunch of sand out and have a band come and play, and people kind of dance the night away, and we have concession food and kids' games set up. So lots of fun.
All right. Lots of opportunities to get outdoors this summer at Fort Stevenson State Park. Chad Troutman is the park manager there. Chad, thank you so much for your time today.
Awesome. Thank you, Ashley. I appreciate it.
Maple Sugaring Day is April 13th, starting at 10 a.m. Dakota Datebook is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Jerry Doan. He's with the North Dakota Grazing Lands Coalition. He'll talk about all the factors that go into grazing lands and ranching, and we'll have a musical performance from Melissa Curren. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 9th. Today marks the anniversary of two controversial events having to do with the burial sites of two of our most famous Native Americans. Sitting Bull was killed on the Standing Rock Reservation in 1890. He was buried at Fort Yates on the North Dakota side of the reservation. On this date in 1953, a group stole the bones and reburied them near Mobridge to help promote the Sitting Bull Stampede Rodeo. Most Lakota maintain that the stolen bones aren't Sitting Bulls. In fact, North Dakota sued and tested one of them, and it was female. Historian LaDonna Brave Bull noted that the grave had already been robbed or opened six times between 1890 and 1900. She says the people of the reservation's Rock Creek District believe the bones were removed long ago and reburied in an unmarked grave, making neither of the so-called official sites the true resting place. Another controversy surrounds the death and burial of Sacagawea. Many maintain that she died on this date in 1884. Most historians, however, believe she died much earlier, in 1812, at Fort Manuel Lisa. If the 1812 version is true, Sacagawea became ill and died when she was approximately 25 years old. This version centers on the journal of the fort's head clerk. His entry states, "This evening, the wife of Charbonneau, a snake woman, died of a putrid fever. She was a good and the best woman in the fort, aged about 25 years. She left a fine infant girl." In 1962, another piece of evidence came to light in the form of an account book dated 1825 to 28, belonging to William Clark. On the cover, he listed the whereabouts of his expedition members, which included the notation, "Sacagawea, dead." But some historians note that Charbonneau had two wives, and both were snake or Shoshone women. And many oral traditions say that Sacagawea lived to be about 100 years old and is buried on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. According to those oral histories, Sacagawea left Charbonneau and headed west from St. Louis, visiting several tribes before settling with the Comanche. There she married and raised a family. When her new husband died, she traveled up the Missouri River in search of her own people and was reunited with son Jean-Baptiste, the baby she carried during the Lewis and Clark expedition. Today there are monuments to Sacagawea at both the presumed site of her 1812 death in South Dakota and the 1884 gravesite in Wyoming. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In most states, if you're brought to trial and can't afford an attorney, the state provides one. And if you're found innocent, you are still slapped with a bill.
So really, by definition, this whole process is really designed to squeeze blood from a stone.
So should the law be changed?
We're asking you to support a service that you're provided, but it's not meant to be a punishment.
Not guilty, but still charged. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we examine health care from many different angles, starting with veterans and some of the issues facing our country vets, as we visit with Robert Wilkie, who is the VA secretary. We also learn about health care when it comes to animals as Harvest Public Media wraps up its three-part series on contagious diseases and a new lab for studying them. And we learn about long-term care and the challenges of providing long-term care. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.